So we're here with Todd Young, congressman running for United States Senate. Todd, the easy answer is why are you running?
I'm running for United States Senate for people like my parents. My dad's a small businessman. My mom is a registered nurse. Like most Hoosiers, they're not particularly political people, but they happen to be conservative people. They're frustrated with Washington's inability to get significant things done, whether that's repealing existing laws or advancing legislation that needs to advance. I believe my record shows I can get things done. I can be an effective, responsible Hoosier conservative. Second reason I'm running is based on what I learned at the Naval Academy and in the Marine Corps. The world is a very dangerous place, and it only becomes more dangerous if the U.S. turns our back on the world, economically, diplomatically, and yes, even militarily. Only strong nations can consistently form alliances, deter aggression, and where necessary, win wars. And the last reason I'm running is very personal. Has to do with Abby, Ava, Anna, and Tucker, who happen to be my four children. And Jenny and I want for them what every Hoosier family wants for their children, their grandchildren, the neighbor kids, the next generation, even the unborn. And you know what? They aren't very ideological things. We want a quality education that turns into a good paying job that ultimately leads to a meaningful career in places like Indiana. And I believe that the course we've been headed on in Washington is not creating an environment where the next generation or even current generations of workers can enjoy such things. We need a strong pivot towards a different policy agenda, an agenda I've had some measure of success in advancing during my very short time in public service.
You know, we're very close to Illinois, where they haven't passed a budget since 9 months and change ago.
Yeah,
basically. So that's unfortunately kind of a familiar situation for Congress.
Yes.
With the continuing resolution. So how do you get past that? How do you get the budget process back on track?
Well, I've consistently supported responsible budgets make tough decisions about some of our largest programs of government and their lack of sustainability, and don't balance our budget on the backs of our nation's seniors, which is really important. So for starters, we need bold budgets that can be supported by people like me in Congress, and then we need to elect more people to the House and the Senate that will not only help author these budgets, but will support them. And so that's where I'm at. I think we haven't seen enough bold decisions baked into the budget more recently. I am a little concerned, more than a little concerned, about the level of spending in this most recent budget. But in the end, it's just going to require electing the right people, and it's also going to require some presidential leadership to set the right tone and to persuade members of one's party that they should support a budget that calls for some bold changes.
What does a bold budget look like?
A bold budget makes Social Security sustainable, makes Medicaid sustainable, makes Medicare sustainable. These are, in fact, the largest programs of government, and they currently comprise roughly two-thirds of our federal spending. And within roughly a decade, the numbers change based on different assumptions and so forth. They'll comprise roughly three-quarters of our federal spending. So if we're not dealing in a more detailed way with how we intend to reform these programs, then we're missing the boat on the federal budget. That's not to say there aren't efficiencies that can be realized within what is called discretionary spending, those annual spending decisions that we're required to make. And we've found a lot of those efficiencies. In fact, since I first came to Congress, I played a role in drafting that first Ryan budget, as it's been called, that's led to the cutting of $5 trillion of spending at the federal level and cut our federal deficit in half. I'm proud to have played a part there, but there's further work to do. And I think much of it involves making those programs I mentioned sustainable. The other piece of the equation, of course, is to ensure that our economy grows faster by reforming the tax code, making it simpler, reforming our regulatory system. Just those two actions right there could take us from 2% rate of growth to 4% rate of growth, which translates into a whole lot more jobs being created that pay better and ultimately create the wealth that help households buy, take care of their basic necessities, and but also help fund all the basic functions of government that we want to collectively fund.
Do you have some specific thoughts or ideas, if you are successful in your run, that you will take to the Senate that you want to promote to that could be considered in helping make Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid more sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. And I haven't hesitated to go on record about these things in the past. So one of the first things I would do is I would take a look at the Medicare Part D prescription drug structure. It's a very popular program among America's seniors. It actually has come in under budget by roughly 40%, if I recall the number correctly. I can't think of any federal government program that's ever come in under budget by 40%, but it's done that by harnessing the forces of competition. So the way the program is designed, I don't imagine anyone hears on Medicare Part D prescription drug, but it allows seniors to choose among a number of different prescription drug plans, and those plans will compete for the seniors' business. Mm-hmm. So that's led to more value at lower cost, high customer satisfaction. If we were to take that model and apply it to the larger Medicare program, we too would recognize more value at lower cost. And for those seniors who are apprehensive about this change, we could exempt seniors who not only have retired but who are approaching retirement. We've made efforts in recent years to exempt those, say, 55 and older from any changes whatsoever if they so choose, just because of the anxiety associated, understandably, with any reforms to these programs. But I think in the end we'll find that seniors will choose a reformed Medicare plan where they can get more value at lower cost as opposed to traditional Medicare. This is a way to keep Medicare around, which is something we all should care about. With respect to Medicaid, I think taking a given sum of money, probably roughly what is already spent per state, and giving it back to each of the states, and then allowing the states to figure out how to best manage that program with fewer strings attached, will lead to more administrative efficiencies and improvements in operating the Medicaid program. And then each of the states can learn from other states' examples. Some will come up with really effective models and popular models. Some will come up with less effective and less popular models, but the laboratories of democracy that were envisioned by our founding fathers could actually function, and we could come up with a more sustainable, better Medicaid model. Social Security, people my generation aren't expecting a whole lot of Social Security. I think we could lift our expectations by increasing our rate of economic growth, bringing more money into the federal treasury so that we can fund important programs like Social Security. But, someone my age might have to work a little bit longer before I can draw on Social Security. We also need to take a look at how we measure cost of living. This is a bit of a technical issue, but many economists will say that we overstate the cost of living in different geographies through the Consumer Price Index. And so that can be adjusted, again, for younger generations, those who aren't currently in the system or very close to the system, thus reducing the cost of the program.
Could you point to a couple things in the last couple years that you feel particularly proud of getting done?
Yes, and this is a distinction. I could point to a lot of things. And
maybe the top two or three.
I will. But this point goes to the heart of my qualifications and one of the reasons I'm running for United States Senate. You see, I'm a Hoosier conservative. Hoosiers are not just about, you know, we're not D.C. politicians. We're not about talking a good game. We're about rolling up our sleeves and actually getting things done. And I have a record of coming up with solutions to pressing challenges, whether it's from welfare reform to unique models to financing higher education during a time when families are worried about how they're going to finance higher ed, to regulatory reform initiatives, to repealing the most egregious provisions of Obamacare. I have actually developed plans to do that, persuaded my colleagues, Republican and Democrat, of the merits of my plans, and been able to advance those plans forward. You won't find others in this race who are both conservative and who can say they've done that. So some examples I'll cite. One is the RAINS Act. The RAINS Act is the signature regulatory reform initiative of the Republican Party. I have led the initiative for the last couple of Congresses to get that bill passed out of the House of Representatives. And we're normalizing the idea to such an extent that it has now become part of the Republican national platform. And every Republican presidential candidate has embraced it. They've run on it. It would require every major regulation coming out of all the alphabet soup agencies of Washington, D.C., whether it's a major IRS regulation or EPA regulation or Health and Human Services, Obamacare regulation, or the waters of the United States and so forth, they'd all have to come before Congress for an up or down vote. This is designed, of course, to check executive power, but it's also designed to allow the American people to hold their legislators accountable for the major rules we have to live by. You see, D.C. politicians have a habit of vaguely addressing politically difficult issues and then leaving it up to the unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats to fill in the gaps, then going back home and blaming the unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. I want to be held accountable for the major rules. The RAINS Act would affect that sort of change. Another initiative I'm really proud of is what is called the Saving American Workers Act. It would repeal the 30-hour work week provision of Obamacare and restore the 40-hour work week. This perversely, this 30-hour provision, employers that employ 50 or more people who work 30 or more hours per week are required to provide them federally approved Obamacare health insurance. Now, a number of employers cannot afford to provide all their hourly workers this sort of mandated health insurance with all the bells and whistles associated there, too. So, instead, they are incentivized to drop the employees, worst case scenario, from 39 hours down to, say, 29 hours. This is not only an administrative burden to track the hours, but it results, again, worst case scenario, in a situation where over the course of a month, someone loses 40 hours, an entire works week worth of wages. This is why we have public school corporations, a couple dozen in the state of Indiana, who have sued the federal government on account of this provision. It's why fast food restaurants and their employees are feeling the effects of this. And this was the number one priority of the National Restaurant Association to advance this legislation forward. It's why Indiana University, back where I live, has indicated that they've had challenges with this provision. Ivy Tech Community College, I could go on and on. But the point is, we are feeling the effects of this in the real world, and I'm proud of those two initiatives. Again, be very happy to bore you with additional legislative efforts, and we could supplement later on. Yeah.
So the Supreme Court...
And incidentally, I've taken conservative ideas, and in so many of these cases, had the ability to persuade not just Tea Party patriots, though I've persuaded them, not just suburban, Republicans, but even some fair-minded independents and Democrats of the merits of my ideas. And I think that's what Hoosiers are looking for.
So the Supreme Court is nominees and other federal judgeships. You know that the Senate's been really slow to confirm.
It is the deliberative body,
for the past three decades, I should say.
Right, yeah.
Well, yeah, deliberative.
I'm kidding, of course, yeah.
The quote marks are very appropriate for that.
Yeah.
So what would you do about the process?
With respect to the Supreme Court
nomination? And the federal judgeships. I mean, why is it taking so long to fill positions?
Well, I think so often when we have delays in Washington and an inability to get things done, that is a function of D.C. politics, political gamesmanship, too much self-interestedness. But occasionally, it's a function of principled disagreement. And I think with respect to judges in particular and their nomination, there's principled disagreement between conservatives and liberals about how to read the Constitution of the United States. I actually think that federal judges ought to begin with the text itself and try and determine the original meaning of the words or the intended meaning of the words. And if that can't be determined based on historical documents and documents pertaining to the debates surrounding the framing of the Constitution and the words themselves and old dictionaries and so forth, then we use the meaning as we understand it today. The progressive vision is one I find fundamentally flawed. It actually involves the living, breathing Constitution, right? I think we have a living, breathing Constitution already. We have an amendment process. And the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the very structure of the Constitution that lays out these are the powers of our federal government, indicate to me that the intent was to have a Constitution of very limited powers, only to be expanded through the amendment process as laid out. So what I'm getting to is there are real disagreements here, and these disagreements aren't always unconstructive. I think having these public debates, and in the end, leaving it to the American people to elect whichever U.S. senators they think are best equipped to choose justices that share their interpretation of the Constitution will come up with fair-minded decisions rather than ones that might be fashionable at major law schools. That's part of the democratic process.
But they already elect senators, and how do you know the answers if you don't hold the hearings?
That's a different question, I believe. Unless I misunderstood the first
question. Well, the question is, you've got all these delays. Vote them up or down, but, if you're not holding them.
Yeah, so the constitutional, and as you know, the constitutional mandate for the United States Senate is the advice and consent provision, right? And as so many of our framers understood that provision, the advice component should precede the nomination. It doesn't follow the nomination. So it's not as though the president gets to nominate whomever they like and automatically said nominee receives a hearing. Instead, the Republican majority United States Senate, as we have right now, ought to advise a president. This is the sort of nominee we would approve. So I would actually favor a tactic of providing this president with a big binder. He already has his big binder from which he chose his current nominee, right? So why not offer an alternative binder and say these are the types of nominees that we would approve? Some of them may have been nominated under Bill Clinton. That would be even more convenient, right? If they happen to be strict constructionists or textualists or those who dive into the actual text of the Constitution, it would be easier to arrive at a nominee. I think under this president too, let's admit that these nominations occur in the midst of a political atmosphere, right? Sometimes a very highly charged political atmosphere. We're in one of those historic moments right now where it's a very charged political atmosphere. The American people spoke very clearly just over a year ago when they elected by a fairly large margin a Republican United States Senate. So they spoke. And so that's a counter to those who say that this is a duly elected president and he ought to be able to get a hearing for his nominees. Well, there's also a duly elected United States Senate more recently. But my preference is to wait until, in light of the politically charged atmosphere, take what has been colloquially referenced as the Biden rule, which he had deep conviction for this rule some years ago. I guess he's backed off a bit, but I think it's appropriate to allow the American people to weigh in this election before the Senate takes up a nominee. And also understand it as a practical matter, even if the justice or the nominee that's been put forward did receive a hearing and were confirmed, although I think it would all be a very much circus-like atmosphere, he wouldn't sit until October. So, you know, how much time are you really losing there by not holding a hearing and not subjecting this president, the nominee, and the American people to an unfair politically charged process?
Would you still feel that way if the sitting president were Republican?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think, the Biden rule ought to be known as the Biden rule of thumb. And when you're in the midst of a politically charged atmosphere, as we are now, I think we can expect no more than theatrics, hyperbole, and hyper-politicized decisions within the legislature. And so let's allow the American people to decide this November exactly which direction we should go with respect to our judiciary.
Do you have concerns, though, over an example that just came out of the Supreme Court? It was a 4-4 ruling. And
No.
It was supposed to be a conservative win. And it ended up not being so because it was a 4-4 ruling.
So that...
Because they're missing a justice.
That decision can be revisited. That legal question can be reconsidered in a future case. And it will be. And so, no, this is not a crisis of our republic. And I think too often in the sensationalized news culture that sometimes we live in, I'm not casting aspersions here, referencing more radio and television, but and online, but we get worked into a frenzy that somehow there is a crisis. There will not be a crisis if a given case is not heard and our circuit courts disagree in a particular legal matter. We can revisit that legal matter at a later date and America will be just fine.
I wonder, you guys have gone 50,000 miles in a short time.
Yeah.
What are you here? When you visit, you speak, there is this political charged atmosphere, but it's over there somewhere. I mean, are you hearing that in your
Oh, I've been on the front lines of the politically charged atmosphere.
Right.
It's very real, and I know the first thing most Hoosiers want you to acknowledge is their frustration, which I share. Their even anger at times about the inability of Washington D.C. To get conservative things done, whether that's repealing initiatives or advancing new ones, and making the sorts of hard decisions that they have been led to believe would be made in recent years. So acknowledge their frustration and anger, and frankly, I'm running for United States Senate to try and alleviate some of that frustration and anger and play a constructive role.
So
on their behalf.
You know, we're talking, you know, the end game, November and beyond, but let's talk about May. What separates you from your opponent?
Well, one would be biography. I'll let others speak to their biographies, but we've done different things in life, naturally, right? So I come from a small business family. Told you about my mom. I had an opportunity to attend the U.S. Naval Academy, where I was trained in public leadership and military leadership. I had an opportunity to serve my country in uniform as a U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer, trained in counterterrorism, which I would argue is particularly relevant to this time, enabling me to more effectively keep Americans safe and secure. When I was in the military, I spent time in the southern border working on new doctrine for our military to figure out how we might integrate drone technology in keeping our borders secure. I've worked on counter-narcotics missions. I've been educated in economics, so I think having some familiarity with economics and how to get our economy growing, that's a helpful discipline during this time period. My opponent, I have children. I think we all want an environment where our children can enjoy more opportunity and therefore be more hopeful about the future. So biography would be one. Records of accomplishment would be another. During my short time period that I've been in office, I could run through a litany of things where I've come up with concrete solutions to pressing challenges and persuaded others of their merits and been able to move them forward. I'll allow you to see how many bills my opponent has passed since he's been in Congress. I say that respectfully, but I happen to believe that our vision of what the job of a United States senator is different. I think that if all you're doing is giving speeches and casting votes, you're missing roughly two-thirds of the job of the U.S. Senator, which is to actually come up with solutions, working with subject matter experts, working with Hoosiers and other stakeholders. So we've covered biography, we've covered record of accomplishment. I guess the last thing is just, I'm not a career politician. I'm not a Washington, D.C. politician. I live in Indiana with my family. I first ran for office back in 2010. Had never run for anything before in my life. And I've earned the trust and support of a number of people since that time. Let me add one more thing. I've actually won tough races. In fact, this Marine has beaten Barron Hill, and I can beat Barron Hill again. And I'm the only one who can definitively and confidently say that in this race. And this is at a time when Republicans nationally are defending 24 United States Senate seats. Democrats only 10. Our majority is only 4. So if one of your readers happens to be a Republican and they think that we need to maintain a conservative majority in the United States Senate, their vote has never been more important, and it's essential that we choose a battle-tested nominee who can beat Barron Hill in the fall. I know I'm not sticking to your short formulation. I speak in paragraphs. I'm sorry.
You're doing fine.
Yeah, it's good.
All right.
you mentioned a couple of questions ago about bold budget decisions and bold presidential leadership. Are you backing anyone in particular?
No. I feel duty-bound to focus intently on this U.S. Senate race because of the potential consequences of it. I'm working so hard, I don't have a whole lot of time to pay attention to the race. I know that the race will play itself out. The Republicans will go ahead and collectively we'll choose who our next nominee is. And I really don't think it's my place to tell people who to vote for, to characterize the nominees one way or another, and so forth. So my intent, however, is to support the Republican nominee. We'll see who that is.
Okay.
Share a little bit about your what you would want to do with the military and terrorism time, you know, and what kind of action steps? What kind of would you see the Senate, you know, trying to get done if you're elected?
You know, part of the job in the national security realm of a U.S. senator, not unlike a member of the House of Representatives, but with more prerogatives, is to ask probing questions of our top ambassadors of the national security team for our president, of our top military officers. And my experience in the military would inform my questions. Number one, it would keep me from being intimidated by people who happen to have spent a lifetime either in the military or the foreign service or so forth. I've seen and worked with some of these individuals, and I've seen up close and personal that they are not infallible, and so I'm not intimidated to ask hard questions of military personnel. So that would be part of my role. More specifically, I would push the next president, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, to make sure we always have a coherent strategy to accomplish whatever aims we put forward, whatever mission we want to accomplish. And what President Obama has not done, for example, with respect to ISIS, is put forward a coherent, cohesive strategy to win. And so this ought to be a nonpartisan thing. One would hope we could get returned to a day, hopefully in the fairly near term, where these foreign policy matters are nonpartisan or less partisan. And so I would push for that. I would make sure our military is fully resourced, and any other agencies that help keep Americans safe and secure, like the Department of Homeland Security and the essential services it provides, is fully resourced. These are some of the things. Do you have any follow-ups? Because I mean, I'm sure there's some areas that I've overlooked.
No, I didn't know if you were
going
to point to one or two areas. I mean, I think it's enough.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Anything else? We're covering a lot. Anything we have?
We've got to take care of our men and women in uniform.
Right.
I would add that, and also veterans. And I say that.
How? How would you improve that current situation? Follow-up care after they've gotten out of the military, for example.
Well, we need to continue. Let me start with while they're in the military. It is unfair to our current military men and women to have an incoherent strategy, and one that is, frankly, not really designed to win a given conflict. Because if we throw our men and women into an atmosphere where conflict will just linger on and arguably grow worse over a period of time, that's immoral. And so
which theater are you talking about?
The Middle East.
Okay.
Yeah, Syria and Iraq. Okay. Syria and Iraq in particular. That's not to say that the situation couldn't become more dangerous in other areas, mm-hmm. right? But that's specifically the area. Defeating ISIS, we have, and other terrorist groups. We have an incoherent, it's a non-strategy. Beyond that, we just need to make sure that our veterans receive the military, sorts of healthcare services that are required, that they deserve, that they have earned by serving our country. There are some unique issues that are if not unique to veterans, then disproportionately impact our veterans. One would be post-traumatic stress disorder. We need to do more research in this area. I favor more pilot programs so that we can come up with evidence-based interventions to figure out how we can, with a high level of certainty, serve veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And so this is something government more broadly needs to do a lot more of, is fund pilot projects, study them, and then scale up those things that actually work. And continued investment in prosthetic advancements, many of those advancements occurring right here in Indiana, but that's neither here nor there. You know, these sorts of things. And then look for ways to support the military caregivers, too, whether they're family members or others. Mm-hmm. It's heart-wrenching to know that we have spouses and others who are struggling to take care of someone who has so bravely served our country, and they're going through unique challenges, and I think we need to look after them. We need to look after the children of those who are serving in our military, worst case scenario, those who passed away in service to our country. And so these are some examples of the constellation of things that I think we ought to be doing so that the next generation will find serving in the military attractive and understand that collectively we respect the sacrifices and service of our men and women in uniform. And I'm sure that my friends in the Navy and Marine Corps will tell me I missed a few, but
With regards to the Middle East, do you have specific thoughts of what could, should be done over there in terms of providing greater guidance?
I do. I have some specific thoughts, and I'm happy to volunteer those to you. I have called for, however, development of a multinational response and a multinational strategy to defeat ISIS and other terrorist groups. That means invocation of Article 5 of NATO. The NATO Treaty, North Atlantic Treaty, is between the United States, as you know, and Europeans and Canadians, and it was Article 5 is the Mutual Defense Clause of that NATO Treaty. It was last invoked right after 9/11. You see, 9/11 wasn't an attack just on the United States of America. It was regarded as an attack on the West and of our allies. And so collectively, we decided we were going to fight al-Qaeda. And respond to the threat. And so one noticed after the Paris attacks that we had French leadership visiting with President Obama, and I strongly suspect there was some conversation there about invocation of Article 5 and if the president was prepared to lead there, because in the end Americans would play leading role in a military response and need to be part of strategy development, then we would have had invocation of Article 5 by the French, and then we could have collectively developed a strategy. And then I would encourage pulling into that overall strategy some of our partners in the region, in the Middle East themselves, countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, who we've had strong ties in varying ways and to differing degrees and at different times over the years, but countries that have the wherewithal to put boots on the ground, Middle Eastern boots on the ground, to assist with the implementation of any overall strategy. You really have to start with that. Now, some components of that strategy are pretty easy for me, this Marine, to tease out. One would be we need to fly more sorties. And we need to utilize more effectively our troops that are already on the ground so that each of those bombing sorties can be more accurate and we can disrupt supply lines, fuel lines, and so forth. Another thing we need to do is pool our intelligence with a broader collection of countries. You know, as a Marine Corps intelligence officer, I know that the extent to which you pull from a broader pool of bits and bytes of data, you can get a more coherent, comprehensive picture of exactly what threats are out there. And so, you know, you've got the military leg of the national security triangle. You've got the intelligence leg, which needs to be more robust. And the final piece of this is the law enforcement leg of the triangle, if you will. And we can assist the Belgians, the French, and others with our expertise. And I suspect, you know, we could learn a little ourselves along the way by coming up with some more exchanges on the law enforcement end and work together to keep Americans and our allies safe and secure.
What about the rebuilding piece? Do you see that as fitting in there at some point? Helping, so for example, we took this approach with both Syria and Iraq. Say we've been successful, we've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish over there militarily, we have a law enforcement leg that is set up. However,
you mean sort of a foreign aid or an investment dimension to it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, that is something I'm open to debating. My very strong suspicion is if you establish, if you have stability within the region, mm-hmm. that would be step number one. Step number two would be to make sure that you have governments in place that respect basic property rights and establish rules to facilitate the development of a market economy. Then these countries can grow their own wealth. That's not to say that foreign aid isn't, in some instances, an important foreign policy tool, as people like Condoleezza Rice and former Defense Secretary Gates and Secretary Colin Powell, they make these points on a regular basis. It is an important tool. But what we don't want to have happen is to have foreign aid be wasted or to have it facilitate autocratic regimes using that money to line their own treasuries without really representing their own people. And that would constitute you've got taxation without representation. You know, in some of these countries, you actually have representation without taxation. They figure it out either through oil wealth or mm-hmm. You think of some countries, many of them located, say, in sub-Saharan Africa, which receive foreign aid or have historically, and they've never felt the need to really represent their citizens because the leaders are doing just fine. Mm-hmm. Yes,
right.
Right. So we got to be very intelligent about how we deploy this foreign aid. Yeah. I gave you a nuanced answer. I hope it's well received.
Well, and I want to drill down just a little bit on that. In terms of foreign aid, I understand what you're talking about in economic growth and letting that organically grow itself.
Yeah.
One of the pieces that I'm wondering about is your thoughts on helping them rebuild, for example, infrastructure and so on and so forth, so they can grow economically.
You know what? The United States of America, we spend a greater portion of our gross domestic product on our military than our European allies. Mm-hmm. We do so much for the world, and I take great pride in the fact that we do, right? But my preference would be to ask those in the Middle East, the Europeans and others, the Japanese, to step up. We have some challenges here domestically we'd like to address as well. So we can do what the United States has historically done, which is lead, and we must. internationally. But there are some areas where I think through strong diplomacy, which we haven't seen from this Obama administration, we can get others to step up to a greater degree.
Do you mind if I ask you a follow-up question on the pilot programs that you mentioned?
Yeah, I love this topic. It's probably not going to be real compelling. That's not a criticism of your question. But, you know, when I go out and make speeches, I don't talk a lot about pilot programs, but I actually really like evidence-based practices. And let's dive deep.
Yeah. Studies and pilot programs are fantastic.
Yeah.
But where the true success comes is whether or not they're actually implemented in the end.
That's right.
Longer term. Yeah. So I guess my question to you is, would you see the need to put a time limit on a pilot program, and what would that look like?
So yeah, time limits. Sunsets are great. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I think we need to be sunsetting major regulations and all manner of other laws, right, so that Congress has to continuously revisit these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they may have once worked, and they, for whatever reason, the environment has changed, and they work less effectively. Maybe they never worked. And this is a sort of a pressure point that requires Congress to revisit something that may be very popular, but the evidence strongly suggests is ineffective. So I absolutely favor sunsets. But let me talk, if I've answered your question, I hope I have. Let me talk a bit more about pilot programs and the importance. Let's choose the social services space. There are, depending upon how one counts it, roughly 95 different federal programs designed to serve the poor or the at-risk, vulnerable Americans. Of those 95 programs, only 10 have ever been rigorously studied using the gold standard of evaluation. That's multi-site, randomized controlled trial. And of those 10 of 95 that have been studied, only one has been found to work. The record, that's Early Head Start. And then the benefits of Early Head Start taper off over a period of years. So even that program, and it's spotty, it's effectiveness from site to site, right? It depends very much on who's implementing it. So we have to stop measuring our compassion based on the amount of money we throw at a problem. With respect to our nation's, as it's often broadly called, our welfare programs, work ought to always pay more than joblessness, and we should never be funding a program that has not been found to work through an evidence base. And if we're not quite sure how to address a given problem, then why don't we allow the most robust civil society in all of human history, the United States of America, to develop within our communities, the not-for-profits, our churches, even the private sector, to develop interventions that work. You know what? Those interventions exist. There are evidence-based interventions to get foster children into forever adoptive homes more quickly than government can do it. There are interventions to ensure that low-income mothers don't give birth to low birth weight babies, or even worse, the babies die. There are interventions for seemingly every social ill that are being carried out by not-for-profit communities and churches and so forth. The real challenge during this time of scarce resources is to figure out how to scale those up, to take them from one geography to another, and then replicate them with fidelity. And I happen to have authored legislation, bipartisan in nature, informed by my visit to the United Kingdom and what they have done to reform their welfare system. That would allow private money to be spent on scaling up some of these evidence-based solutions to, say, reduce recidivism. If certain agreed-upon outcomes are met, then the investors, private investors, whether they're foundations or high-net-worth individuals or whatever, they're paid back out of future government savings. You see, when you actually help people, you save Medicaid dollars. You save money that would have otherwise been spent on building new prisons or on prison personnel. And you can literally come up with some level of specificity, the projected savings, if results are met. You pay back the investors out of those future savings. with a positive ROI, that money can be redeployed to help more people. You learn from the lessons of those replications and continuously improve them, and it creates a sort of market, a dynamism within this social support space. This is probably strikes you as a very conservative idea. It's got bipartisan support. This is an example of Hoosier conservative leadership. It's not enough to give speeches. It's not enough just to show up and take my voting card here and put it in a box and vote red or green. Heck, some people even read off scorecards when they cast those votes. That doesn't take a whole lot of proficiency. Instead, we need to be coming up with creative solutions to challenging problems. And I want to play a role in the United States Senate doing that.
Nice way to come full circle.
Yeah. I think we covered a lot. Anything we want to talk about that we didn't ask you, or you could do it, give us a closing about what this race is?
I'll just give you a closing characterization as we head into this Republican primary, which is before us, and it will be very tight and concise. I'm a pro-life, pro-gun Marine, and I want to repeal and replace Obamacare. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Thank you so much.